Welcome to Iris for Sunday, June 6, 2021. My name is Trevor, and I'll be bringing you the Sioux City Journal. Let's take a quick look at the weather for the next few days. Today, we can expect the weather to be partly sunny, breezy, and hot, with winds 12 to 25 miles per hour and a high of 91 degrees. Tonight will be partly cloudy and mild with the winds about 7 to 14 miles per hour and a low of 68 degrees. Monday, it'll be very warm with sun and some clouds, looking at a high of 90 degrees and a low of 68. Tuesday, it'll be mostly sunny and very warm, looking at a high of 90 degrees and a low of 67. Wednesday, it'll be hot with times of clouds and sun, high of 92 and a low of 68. Thursday, hot with some sun showers at the nighttime, high of 95, low of 65. Returning back to the front page of today's Sunday paper, the Journal editorial board provides our mini editorial for today, and they write, "The forecast called for temps to soar into the 90s for three straight days this weekend, and we just entered June. Makes you a little uneasy about what July and August will bring." Signed, the Journal Editorial Board. All right, let's look to our front page story, the Clay County, South Dakota bond issue. Headline, vote set on $41 million project. And the front spread photo depicts the Clay County Courthouse in Clay County, South Dakota, which is in the town of Vermilion. Subheadline, officials say aging courthouse, jail facilities are outdated. From Vermilion, South Dakota. Clay County voters on Tuesday will decide on a $41 million bond issue that, if passed, would fund construction of a new courthouse, jail, and law enforcement center. The county seeks to build a government complex in a yet-to-be-announced location in Vermilion. Supporters say the current courthouse, built in 1912, is outdated and in need of costly repairs, and the 20-bed jail does not meet state and federal codes. Plans call for a 44-bed jail and law enforcement center attached to a single-story courthouse. The current courthouse would be vacated and maintained in hopes that a buyer would find a new use for it. Quote, "It's just worn out. It's past its useful life," Clay County Commission Chairman Travis Mockler said. Quote, "You can fix what's wrong with the current courthouse. It's how much money do you want to throw at it?" Question mark. Opponents of the measure want to see the historic courthouse preserved rather than replaced. Quote, "Our number one goal is to maintain the current courthouse as the center of county government," said Dan Christofferson, a former Vermilion mayor and chairman of the Save Our Historic Clay County Courthouse Committee. Quote, "The only way for us to save the building currently is to vote against the bond issue and force the county commission to fix it up." Polls will open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. The measure needs a simple majority to pass. Mockler said the current proposal is the cheapest of the options that were considered. The county's consultants looked at remodeling the courthouse, which is on the National Register of Historic Places, and noted for its neoclassical architecture. Mockler said the building would need to be gutted in order to replace aging plumbing, electrical, and air handling systems, and to install a fire suppression system, which the courthouse currently lacks. Costs are estimated at $16 million. That doesn't include construction of a new jail and law enforcement center. Other options are remodeling the courthouse and building a new jail and law enforcement center, either at the current location or off-site, were estimated to cost more than $54 million. Mockler said the jail, now more than 100 years old, is the driving factor in the bond measure. A 1989 addition of the law enforcement centers to house the Clay County Sheriff's Office and Vermilion Police Department also included a jail expansion that increased capacity to 20 beds, too small to meet current needs. Mockler said the jail's inability to meet modern codes has made it a liability, and the county is spending $10,000 to $15,000 each month to house excess Clay County inmates in other counties. Quote, "No matter what happens with our bond, our jail is going to have to close," Mockler said. Christofferson said opponents don't deny the need for new jail, but they believe it's an issue separate from the courthouse. Quote, "There are different ways to achieve that," Christofferson said of the new jail construction. He says the county has neglected the courthouse maintenance, and he thinks the $16 million renovation estimate is too high. Gutting the building would not be necessary, you said, and would likely damage or destroy unique features such as the pattern tiled floors, exterior masonry, and woodwork found throughout the building. Quote, it needs a sensitive restoration job that needs to be done by a restoration expert, Christofferson said, adding that the chance of someone buying the building and paying for renovations themselves are, quote, remote. Opponents also say the public has never been shown specific plans for the proposed county government center or been told where it will be located. Literature passed out by the opposition group refers to it as a mystery building on a mystery site. Mockler said the county commission continues to maintain the courthouse, recently approving a new roof and tuck pointing, and would do so after moving out of the building until a new owner could be found. Quote, I'd love to see it repurposed for something, he said. A location for a new courthouse has not been chosen, Mockler said, but potential sites have been identified. If the bond passes, the commission would begin negotiating a land purchase and finalize designs for the new complex. He said the project discussions have been transparent, noting that a citizens committee formed to study the issues have met more than 100 times and invited the public to attend. Mockler said he's optimistic voters will take the opportunity to approve construction of a much-needed new jail in addition to a modern courthouse. Quote, I truly believe the people of Clay County will do the right thing, and that's vote to approve, he said. Christofferson said the bond issue opponents are willing to help the county develop a courthouse restoration plan if the measure is defeated. Quote, we're not against progress, but we want to save this historic building, he said. There's a much better path forward than what's being presented. All right, we'll now return back to the front page of the paper. Headline, homicide suspect linked to prior shootings from Sioux City. Prior to his arrest in connection with the fatal shooting of another man at a rural Woodbury County home Monday, Marvin Hildreth Jr. was no stranger to being accused of violent crimes involving firearms. On one night nearly a year ago, Hildreth was suspected of firing a shot into the air during an assault in Ottawa, Iowa, then shooting another man hours later in Sioux City. Hildreth faces numerous charges related to the Ottawa incident. He was never charged with the June 26 shooting outside the Hillside Apartments in Sioux City, a fact that irks one of the witnesses who was arrested that night after taking the shooting victim, his friend, to the hospital, where police found him in possession of an ammunition clip. Had Hildreth also been arrested after that shooting, Brandon Miller said, he may have remained in jail and Monday's homicide never would have happened. Quote, it made me sick to my stomach that the Sioux City Police Department could have arrested him and they didn't, Miller said of Hildreth's Monday arrest during a phone interview from the Dakota County Jail, where he awaits sentencing in federal court on a charge of being a felon in possession of a firearm. Sioux City Police said they did all they could to make a case against Hildreth, but witnesses were uncooperative and the victim himself didn't want investigators to pursue the case. Investigators were left with little evidence to support an arrest, said department spokesman and community policing sergeant Jeremy McClure. Quote, they pursued several different angles and video and cell phone information and weren't able to get enough evidence to use to charge him, McClure said. When victims and witnesses don't cooperate in an investigation, it's nearly impossible to make an arrest. Quote, if we could have charged him, we would have. The last thing we want is not to charge people who are committing violent acts out on the streets. Hildreth, 20, of rural Whiting, Iowa, was arrested on charges of second-degree murder and going armed with intent in connection with Monday's shooting death of Russell Moore and the non-fatal shooting of a woman at a home at 1932 250th Street in Luton. According to court documents, Hildreth told sheriff's deputies he went to the home to help with the disturbance. He's accused of shooting Moore, age 40, of rural Mapleton, Iowa, several times, then shooting a woman, whom authorities have yet to name, in the hip before driving away. He was taken into custody about half an hour later and remains in custody on a $500,000 bond. Just 10 days earlier, Hildreth had pleaded guilty in Woodbury County District Court to a misdemeanor charge of third-degree theft for stealing items from Sioux City's Fleet Farm store in July. District Associate Judge John Nelson suspended a 30-day sentence, fined Hildreth $625, and placed him on probation for a year. Hildreth was also free on bond in his Monona County case, in which he is charged with intimidation with a dangerous weapon, going armed with intent, willful injury, carrying weapons, and eluding. A trial is scheduled for September 14th. According to court documents, Hildreth and two other men were involved in an assault outside an Ottawa apartment building at about 8:48 p.m. on June 26. After one of the victims had been struck with a baseball bat, Hildreth allegedly told him he was going to kill him, pulled a gun from his waistband, and fired a single shot into the air before leaving the scene. Monona County Sheriff's deputies arrested Hildreth after a short pursuit at around 1 a.m. the following morning. His attorney, Pat Perry of Sioux City, has filed a notice of self-defense in the case. Perry said Friday he could not comment on the defense. In the roughly 4 hours between the alleged assault in Ottawa and his arrest, Hildreth is suspected of traveling about a half hour to Sioux City, where witnesses and court documents say he opened fire on a passenger in a car Miller was driving at about 11:22 p.m. Miller said he had met with a man he knew only as, quote, Ryan, earlier that evening. A tattoo artist, Miller said he didn't know Ryan well, but had agreed to do a tattoo for him. Miller was driving Ryan's car on the way to the Hillside Apartments, where they were to pick up mutual friends, Dustin Matheson and his wife. Miller said he noticed a white pickup following them for several blocks. When Miller pulled into the apartment parking lot at 2800 West 4th Street, where Matheson was waiting outside, the pickup's driver pulled in behind him, blocking him. Miller said Ryan pulled out a gun and left it for him in the car, then got out to talk to the pickup driver. Miller said he heard shots, grabbed the gun, and fired a shot towards the pickup in self-defense. He believes Ryan was the shooter's intended target, but doesn't know what led up to the altercation. Ryan escaped injury, and Matheson wound up getting hit in the right elbow and right hip. The shooter drove away, and Ryan ran off, Miller said. He wrapped his belt around Masson's arm to slow the bleeding and drove him to the hospital with Masson's wife. At the hospital, police officers who had been notified of the shooting talked with Miller, searched him, and found the ammunition clip in his pocket. After getting a warrant, they searched the car and found the handgun, which was determined to be stolen. Because he had two prior felony convictions, Miller was taken into custody on charges of being a felon in possession of a firearm and trafficking stolen weapons. He said that after officers read him his Miranda rights at the police station, he exercised his right to have an attorney present and refused to answer questions. He posted bond 2 days later and was released from jail. After seeing Hildreth's picture in the news in connection with his arrest in Ottawa, Miller said he realized it was the same man who had fired the shots that struck Matheson. Miller, 35, remained free on bond until September, when he was arrested after a federal grand jury indicted him on a charge of being a felon in possession of a firearm. He pleaded guilty in February and is scheduled to be sentenced June 21st in U.S. District Court in Sioux City. Tim Doax, Bureau Chief of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Sioux City, said he could not comment on the case until after sentencing and is unable to comment on any potential ongoing investigations. Miller said that after his arrest on the federal charge, he asked his attorney to tell Sioux City Police his account of what happened on June 26 because he wanted Hildreth to face charges. Quote, they pretty much told me I was a liar, Miller said. We can't make them investigate it. McClure said that in the wake of the shooting, Hildreth was identified as a person of interest. Investigators' notes, he said, indicate that Miller, Matheson, and his wife were of little help. Miller had demanded a lawyer, and Matheson signed a release form telling police he didn't want to pursue charges, an action McClure said he's occasionally seen victims of violent crimes take. Matheson and his wife did not return messages seeking comment. In Matheson's case, police did not continue investigation into his shooting, but his consent form would not have prevented them from seeking charges against Hildreth for crimes committed against other witnesses. Again, McClure said that was hampered because witnesses were not forthcoming with details. Sioux City investigators sought to question Hildreth about the shooting while he was in the custody in the Monona County Jail, McClure said, but Hildreth invoked his right to have an attorney and refused to speak to them. Quote, it gets frustrating, McClure said. You know the suspect committed a crime, but you know the potential if you don't get enough evidence, the suspect can remain at large and commit more crimes. Quote, we do have a commitment to get violent people off the streets, but we're still constrained by the bounds of the law. We have to be able to prove our case. McClure said the case is forwarded to the Woodbury County Attorney's Office for review. Woodbury County Attorney Patrick Jennings said his office is still reviewing the complaint filed in the case. The shooting investigation is currently inactive, McClure said, but police will talk to any witnesses who wish to come forward. Since his arrest, Miller has felt the frustration of being the only person arrested after the shooting, while the person who pulled the trigger has never been charged. Miller said he had known Ryan had a gun in the car that night. He never would have gotten in because he was aware that as a convicted felon, he can't own or handle firearms or ammunition, and he's worked hard to stay sober and turn his life around after kicking a methamphetamine habit he said was the cause of his prior criminal activity. Quote, I understand it. I'm not arguing it, he said. I'll answer for my crimes. He just wants the shooter to answer for his actions that night, too. All right. Now, returning back to the front page of today's paper, at the bottom, child care bills should help families with costs, access, advocates say. From the Journal Des Moines Bureau and the Cedar Rapids Gazette from Des Moines. Families who seek more accessible and affordable child care should be helped by legislation approved this year by state lawmakers, advocates and stakeholders say. Not all legislation designed to address a given issue accomplishes its goal, but in this case, groups that have advocated for programs to make child care more accessible and affordable to Iowans say the package of bills approved this year by the Iowa legislature should do just that. Quote, we're really happy with the progress that's been made on child care in Iowa for those families that need support, said Dean Cook, executive director of United Ways of Iowa. Cook said the organization has been working on the issue for more than a decade. Quote, it's a huge win. Advocates say the cost of child care is impacting low-income families who cannot afford it and is keeping others out of the workforce as they find it is cheaper to not work than pay for expensive child care. In Iowa, the average cost for 1 year of infant child care in a center is $10,743. According to the advocacy and resource organization Child Care Aware of America, that is nearly 18% of the state's median income, according to federal census data, and more than the cost of tuition and fees for Iowa students who attend the state's public universities. The annual cost of an infant plus a four-year-old in a center is $19,599, according to Child Care Aware. That is 32% of the state's median household income. State lawmakers this year passed multiple bills designed to help child care cost and access. House File 302 addresses the so-called child care cliff, where a worker begins to earn more income and thus loses eligibility for child care assistance. The bill creates a more gradual phase out of eligibility for assistance as a worker's income rises. Senate File 619 is a wide-ranging tax policy bill that includes doubling of income eligibility for a state child care tax credit. Currently, households earning less than $45,000 are eligible for a roughly $170 tax credit on child care costs. The bill doubles that income threshold to $90,000. House File 260 increases the number of children that can be served in a home setting from 5 to 6. So long as at least one is school-aged. Governor Kim Reynolds has already signed House File 260 into law. The others have passed the Iowa legislature and are awaiting the governor's final decision. Charlena Hurt, 55, of Cedar Rapids, has been a child care provider for 36 years, long enough to care for a second generation of some families. Quote, they already know me, so it's amazing, said the owner of Sunshine Home Child Care Center in Cedar Rapids. As a child development home center with two providers, Hurt is limited to 16 children, with four of those kids needing care only part-time. Right now, she has 13 children in her center because she's holding spots open for current families with babies on the way. She supports the new bills that provide more financial assistance to families. The bill that addresses the child care cliff is especially helpful, she said. Quote, in the past, you make more money and they cut you off. By the time you pay for childcare, you're coming out worse than you were before, Hurt said. I've had clients in the past turn down a raise or promotion because they would lose their childcare assistance. She's less supportive of the new law that increases the number of children allowed in a childcare home setting. Quote, it's not beneficial to those of us who work hard to become registered, Hurt said. Quote, the ones not registered, the State Department of Human Services doesn't come out and do checks on them. You're basically giving them benefits to stay unregistered, and to me, that doesn't seem fair. Sunshine Home Child Care Center kept most of its clients during the COVID-19 pandemic because even if the parents were working from home, they still needed child care. Besides 1 week when Hurt was quarantining because of a possible exposure to the virus, she did not have to close the center, nor did she have any cases among children or staff. Now that Iowans are heading back to their offices, she's getting more calls from panicky parents trying to find care. Quote, I turned down 5 clients calling me a week, she said. Cook said the doubling of the income threshold for the tax credit will help more families that are earning income but not enough to afford child care. The United Way has conducted research on those types of families, calling them ALICE, an individual or family who is asset limited, income constrained, and employed. Quote, they're working, they're churning it out every single month, but they're coming up short, Cook said. The expanded tax credit captures so many more families. Business interests are applauding the approved legislation as well, saying it will help employers find more workers. Quote, for a number of years, even pre-pandemic, we had to continue to hear that talent is the number one issue for our members. They need more of it. And we know from a recent census numbers that Iowa's not growing quite as quickly as the jobs that our members are creating, said Andrea Woodard, Senior Vice President of Government Relations and Public Policy for the Greater Des Moines Partnership, a coalition of central Iowa businesses and chambers of commerce. Child care access and affordability is often a huge part of that. And with a population in the state that hinges heavily on two parents working outside the home, child care is increasingly important in our state, Woodard said. While advocates and stakeholders applauded the significant progress made on child care access and affordability this year, they cautioned that more work remains. Hurt thinks the state should allow some registered child care providers to take on more children if the provider has a good track record and strong parent reviews. Cook said she would like to see lawmakers raise income eligibility thresholds for other programs. Meantime, the legislation that was passed this year represents a strong start, she said. Quote, it has been a difficult more than a year with the COVID-19 pandemic. To see something work out and be so positive for so many people in such a rough time is such a great feeling, she said. Now turning to the inside pages of today's paper. Headline, Sucks Pride Festival Makes a Return, from Sioux City. Joe McCauley says the SUX Pride isn't pronounced phonetically as Sucks Pride anymore. It's pronounced Sioux Pride, because that sounds nicer for a family and community-oriented event. Quote, sucks works, but we always say Sioux, said McCauley, a talkative man who's the executive director of Sioux Pride and performs in drag under the name Martina Shakers. Quote, like around the kid, we've started saying Sioux. Sioux Pride, now in its 5th year, was held at the Sioux City Convention Center Saturday afternoon and into the night. The main draw was, of course, the drag performers, several of whom are award-winning winners on a national and state level. Quote, we have drag performers from Sioux Falls, Des Moines, Omaha, Lincoln, Sioux City, Minneapolis, pretty much the tri-state Midwest area, said Brian Meland, talent director of Sioux Pride. We have a few national title holders. One of the prize winners who performed Saturday was Matthew Steele, a stage name. His legal name is Matthew Armistad, who won the All-American Gent title for 2020. Steele, who comes from Omaha, began performing burlesque shows in Omaha, Lincoln years ago when he was about 19. He joked that he didn't want to publicize any hints of his current age. Quote, when I grew up as a kid, I didn't have the opportunity to do things like theater. I didn't have the opportunity to just kind of explore me and do the things that were fun and wild. I lived in an environment where, when I was a kid, that homosexuality wasn't exactly the most accepted, he said. Tony Pierre, the technical director of the Sioux Pride performances, was on vacation from his job in Washington, D.C. and came to Sioux City to work on the shows. The festival, he said, has historically required a lot from the people who make it happen. He joked that this is the first year he and Meland didn't get into a fight during the festival. Quote, in our old location, I would show up at 8 a.m. on Saturday morning, but I wouldn't leave until 5 a.m. on Sunday morning, Pierre said. A very scaled-down version of Sioux City's LGBTQ+ event was held at the convention center last August. This year's event was essentially back to normal. Quote, we scaled down. Everybody had to wear masks. We had gallons and gallons and gallons of sanitizer at last summer's Pride, McCauley said. Last year was also the first time Sioux Pride had been held in the convention center. McCauley said several other people associated with the event said having it in an air-conditioned convention center is for the best. Temperatures climbed to around 95 degrees Saturday afternoon, so the outdoors would have been unpleasant for all involved, particularly the drag queens, who usually wear heavy makeup, tight-fitting gowns, nylon stockings, and layers of padding. Quote, I'm a drag queen, so having my makeup run down my face is not all that much fun, McCauley said. Quote, dealing with families and younger people and sometimes pets, service animals, having it out in the street, it gets overwhelming heat-wise, Pierre said. Pride Month is in June. It's so warm some of these weekends that it's exhaustion and dehydration that we worry about, so it's great to have air conditioning. The Sioux City Police Department provided some plainclothes officers for security during the daytime and uniform officers in the evening. At some other Pride events this year, notably New York City's Pride Parade, officers were discouraged from attending due to the nationwide controversy surrounding police since the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Quote, even with everything that's gone on with our law enforcement this last year, the Sioux City law enforcement is amazing. We actually have police officers who volunteer to work for us and give their time to the community, Pierre said. Sioux Pride looks somewhat different in the daytime than at night. There were a lot of family-friendly activities during the daylight hours, including rock painting and an event where drag queens read storybooks to kids. In the evening, attendance was limited to those 21 and up, and admission was $10, due in part to the more risque performances. Some of the people like to show a little more skin, but it's still respectful, McCauley said, of the nighttime entertainment. Quote, the jokes are a little more racy, they're a little more drag queen fun, end quote. So, all right, continuing along with the local, state, nation section on page A2, we look to national politics as relates to Iowa. Headline, with earmarks back, Iowa representatives seek $51 million for projects. Subheadline, Grassley, Ernst, Feenstra submit no funding requests. After a 10-year ban on congressional earmarks, Iowa's U.S. House members are seeking more than $51 million for projects ranging from expanding child care centers to replacing a fire station in rural North Iowa to modernizing Mississippi River locks and dams. Quote, rather than the earmarks term often associated with unjustified pork barrel spending, current members prefer to call the request, quote, community project funding. Whatever they're called, earmarks are back in the Democratic-controlled Congress. And despite long-standing concerns about their abuses, many Republicans have joined in seeking funding for projects in their states and districts. Quote, I came to D.C. to be a taxpayer advocate. I am against wasteful spending and believe we need to cut excessive spending, Iowa 1st District Republican Representative Ashley Hinson said. Since taking office in January, she voted against Democratic spending bills that she said, quote, blatantly disrespected taxpayers. Quote, but I was also elected to fight for Iowa, she said, explaining that Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Democratic majority were going to revive earmarks with or without Republicans. Quote, I would rather this money go to Iowa than to California. I want to bring taxpayer dollars back to Iowa to be reinvested at home. In restarting the earmarks process, each House member was allowed 10 requests meeting specific eligibility guidelines, including strong community support, expanding access to services, and local funding matches. Hinson narrowed more than 200 general requests to 10, totaling $26.4 million, ranging from $50,000 for the Leader in Me leadership program in Waterloo to $22.5 million for improving locks and dams on the Mississippi River. In the 2nd District, Republican Representative Marionette Miller Meeks has requested $14.15 million, including $600,000 for a bridge replacement in Scott County, $5 million for an Indian Hills Community College career counseling program, and $750,000 to complete the design phase for a new Iowa City transit operations and maintenance facility. The current 40-year-old facility is over capacity and unable to support more growth, Miller Meeks said in her request. The roof leaks, the bay doors malfunction, and the crumbling concrete and deteriorating brickwork present maintenance challenges, according to Darren Nagel-Gam, Iowa City Transportation Services Director. Democratic Representative Cindy Axne, is seeking nearly $10.7 million in the 3rd District. Her requests range from $100,000 for a Des Moines dental care program to $1.6 million for a Johnston Bridge replacement. Not everyone, however, is on board with earmarking. Faced with Biden administration proposals for an unprecedented $6 trillion in spending, Iowa 4th District Republican Representative Randy Feenstra made no request for the district that includes Sioux City and Mason City. Quote, Feenstra believes it is time for Congress to restore fiscal stability and balance our budget so that we can begin making sound investments in America's future, a spokesman said. He's not alone among Iowa Republicans. The country can't afford earmarks, quote, in some ill-conceived effort to grease the wheels to pass legislation only because it includes pet projects for congressmen, according to Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. Quote, any good that would come from my being able to direct some small amount of federal taxpayer money to some worthwhile pilot project would be dwarfed by the negative effects of restarting the mad scramble for earmarks, he said in March. In discussion within the Senate GOP caucus, Grassley advocated for maintaining the decade-long ban and said he will not seek earmarks. His Iowa colleague, Senator Joni Ernst, called earmarks, quote, a disgrace, just the swamp returning to its normal habitat. Quote, she will triple down her efforts to permanently ban the pork-making process because, according to a statement from her office, it is inherently unfair, lacks oversight, and is not transparent to taxpayers. Grassley is the only member of the Iowa delegation who was in Congress when earmarks were banned. In 2010, the federal debt was an estimated 62% of gross domestic product, he said, adding that the Congressional Budget Office projects it will hit 102% of GDP this year. The infamous $223 million Alaska Bridge to Nowhere often is cited as the earmark that shamed Congress into banning earmarks. However, a 2003 request by Grassley for $50 million to leverage as much as $300 million from other sources for Earth Park, an indoor rainforest at Coralville, is another much-derided earmark that critics pointed to as a reason to end the practice. The rainforest project never was funded. When the GOP gained control of the House in 2011, Tea Party Republicans chose to eliminate the practice. In a State of the Union address that year, Democratic President Barack Obama promised to veto any bill containing earmarks, saying, quote, the American people deserve to know that special interests aren't loading up legislation with pet projects. Hinson and Axne don't see it that way. Their requests are not adding spending to the federal budget. Instead, according to Hinson, who sits on the House Appropriations and Budget Committees, they're asking that money already being designated to certain federal programs be allocated to these projects within those programs. For example, Hinson said, she and Illinois' Democratic Representative Sherry Bustos are asking that the Army Corps of Engineers prioritize the already authorized Mississippi River Locks and Dams Improvement Project within its plans for the next fiscal year, instead of allowing that critical project to sit on the back burner any longer. It's an example of reaching across the aisle and the river to, quote, work together in a constructive way that respects the taxpayers, Hinson said. This project is of critical economic importance to both of our district's economies. An unplanned closure of the locks and dams there would result in a $1.57 billion loss to the economies of 132 counties in 17 states, the congresswoman wrote in their justification. Although Lock and Dam 25 is located in Missouri, Hinson included it at the request of Northeast Iowa's Clayton County Farm Bureau because of its importance to the movement of grain from Iowa to export markets, as well as fuel and other goods upriver to Iowa. The $22.5 million requested represents a down payment on the $1 billion in maintenance backlogs faced by the Corps, which recently received about $2.9 million for essential infrastructure upgrades at Lock and Dam No. 10 in Gutenberg. Giving Congress more of that kind of influence over the approximately $1.4 trillion in discretionary spending it approves each year is one of the goals of resuming the earmark process, according to Democrats. They plan to cap earmarks at 1% of discretionary spending. It's early in the process, a Hinson staffer cautioned, explaining, quote, there's a lot of ifs between the congresswoman's request and then their approval. Making the request is not a guarantee that a project will be funded. It's a commitment to advocate for its funding. In the end, Hinson said, her requests come down to, quote, fighting for investments that Iowa needs or allowing Speaker Pelosi to send this money to projects in San Francisco. Quote, coastal elites don't need any more of Iowa's taxpayer dollars, she said. I wasn't going to allow this money to go to California instead of being invested in Iowa. All right, now looking over to Nebraska and the public universities. Brief. Nebraska universities announce vaccine requirements. Omaha, Nebraska. The University of Nebraska Medical Center will require faculty, staff, and students to document whether they've been vaccinated against the COVID-19 beginning on June 21st. Documentation is required because medical students work with patients in clinics and hospital wards, the Omaha World Herald reported Saturday. Faculty, staff, and students who choose not to get vaccinated will be required to wear masks at medical facilities, and students who are not vaccinated might miss out on clinical placements outside of University of Nebraska partners. The documentation is only required for the medical center and not other campuses in the University of Nebraska system, said June Meza, interim director for the Office of Health Security at UNMC in the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Creighton University will require all students to be fully vaccinated at the Omaha and Phoenix campuses starting on July 7th, said the Reverend Daniel Hendrickson, the university president. Creighton faculty and staff are encouraged, but not required, to get vaccinated. Now we turn to the week in Iowa, recap of news across the state from the past 7 days. In the news, farm worker guilty in girl's death. A farm laborer was found guilty in the abduction and killing of an Iowa college student who vanished while out for a run in 2018 and will face life behind bars for a crime that shocked the nation. A 12-member jury unanimously found Christian Bahina Rivera guilty of first-degree murder in the attack of University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts. Bahina Rivera, who came to the U.S. illegally from Mexico as a teenager, will be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Prison attack. A correctional officer was assaulted by an inmate at the Anamosa State Penitentiary that was the scene of a deadly attack earlier this year. The Iowa Department of Corrections said an inmate, secured in restraints, was being supervised by the officer during a virtual disciplinary hearing with an administrative law judge. Ransomware attack. A ransomware attack on the world's largest meat processing company disrupted production around the world just weeks after a similar incident shut down a U.S. oil pipeline. JBS SA of Brazil, which has three facilities in Iowa, notified the U.S. of a ransom demand from a criminal organization likely based in Russia. Stimulus effect. After a period of economic shutdown intended to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus that has claimed at least 6,000 Iowa lives, state revenues are growing at an unprecedented pace as people spend federal stimulus checks and engage in more activities as Iowa reopens for business, travel, and events, according to the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. Next headline, Democrats' leader steps down. State Representative Todd Pritchard, who has lambasted Republican lawmakers and Governor Kim Reynolds for pursuing a partisan agenda in the midst of a pandemic, announced he's stepping down as leader of Iowa House Democrats. Leading Democrats has been an honor, he said in a statement. However, after discussions with his family, quote, it's time for me to step aside and allow a new member of our caucus to lead. Pritchard, 47, a Charles City lawyer, was re-elected to his fifth term in the House in 2020. He did not indicate whether he'll seek a sixth term in 2022. Potential candidate, Abby Finkenauer, a former Eastern Iowa state lawmaker and congresswoman, is preparing to run for U.S. Senate in 2022, according to an anonymously sourced reports from the Iowa Field Report and Politico. Republican incumbent U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley has not said whether he will run for re-election. Hanusa running. Former state lawmaker Mary Ann Hanusa, a Republican from Council Bluffs, announced her plan to run for the U.S. House in Central and Southwest Iowa's 3rd Congressional District. Incumbent U.S. Representative Cindy Anxney, a Democrat, has not said whether she will run for re-election and is also considering a run for governor. Premature statement. A comment from U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson on the trial of the man accused in the 2018 killing of Molly Tibbetts was sent prematurely while the jury was still deliberating. Hinson's congressional office confirmed the news release was released in error and a clarification was issued. Next, the little stories for under the water cooler heading. Maternal Health. The Iowa Department of Public Health is undertaking strategic planning for statewide maternal health efforts. Officials seek input regarding the strengths, challenges, and areas of focus that are critical regarding maternal health needs. Aviation Plan. The Iowa Department of Transportation seeks public input as it finalizes its aviation system plan, which helps with planning and funding decisions for the state's air transport system. Roadmap. The Iowa Department of Transportation released the 2021 through 2022 version of the Iowa Transportation Map, available in standard fold-out paper form and an electronic version. Odds and ends stories. First indicators grow. Iowa's leading indicators index grew by a record 1.3% in April for the second month in a row. The increase marked the ninth month in the last 10 that the monthly index has risen. Gubernatorial request. Governor Kim Reynolds and five other governors are asking the U.S. Department of Justice to continue its investigation into anti-competitive practices in the meatpacking industry. Guard deployed. Members of the Iowa Air National Guard's 185th Air Refueling Wing from Sioux City are in Scotland this week as part of a multinational exercise known as Formidable Shield. All right, let's now go to the opinion section, page A10. First, do the journal editorial board, and then we'll do the local Siouxland voices. The editorial board, their editorial says, extend Sioux City's swimming pool season. It would have been great to swim on Memorial Day. Unfortunately, Sioux City's public pools were closed. The Riverside Family Aquatic Center, which was scheduled to open for the season on Memorial Day weekend, was shuttered due to the forecast that called for cool, rainy weather. But since Sioux City public schools are not heated, when the high is in the mid-60s and the low is in the 40s, the water remains extremely cold, Recreation Supervisor John Bryan said in a news release the city issued around noon on May 28th, just as the holiday weekend was about to begin. This is not an ideal experience for our pool patrons or our employees. In addition, these conditions may cause hypothermia, particularly for our youth. While Friday and Saturday were unseasonably cool days, temps soared into the 80s on Memorial Day. Riverside instead opened for the season Friday, but the city's two other pools, Leif Erickson and Lewis Pools, aren't slated to open until June 12th. While city officials say the late start at Leif Erickson and Lewis aren't due to lifeguard shortages, which have plagued other communities, it still seems late considering school's out, the days are extremely warm, and the pools close well before the start of school in the fall. Leif Erickson and Lewis are set to close for the season on August 8th, with Riverside to shut down August 15th. Those early closures no doubt are, in capital letters, A-R-E, due to staffing shortages. Most college-aid lifeguards are getting ready to go back to their own school. But this isn't a new problem. Consistently, municipal pools don't get the attention they need. Because they're an amenity for those in the community who don't have ones in their backyard, they should be given priority. City staff should consider those August dates and look for adults who might be able to staff them when the summer help goes away. No doubt, aquatic centers are the long-term solution, but until they're part of the landscape, city officials should read the room and realize it's time to crack the doors and give kids an outlet for the energy from Memorial Day to Labor Day. Splash pads, a fix they suggested after pooling pools in several locations, are not the whole solution. City officials have suggested putting a splash pad at Leif Erickson once the park's 37-year-old pool, which has major structural issues, can no longer be maintained. But the city should reconsider those plans, since that pool, a Northside landmark, serves several neighborhoods within walking distance. Although a regional aquatic center on the north side, in parentheses Mayor Bob Scott suggests somewhere near Northern Valley Crossing, would be nice, it wouldn't be easily accessible for kids without cars or family members who can drop them off. An aquatic center in Leif Erickson Park would be much more user-friendly. When that pool finally opens this summer, do a casual survey of its traffic. On a warm summer day, you'll see it's a place to be, and the people using it are having more fun than you could ever imagine. All right, let's now go to the letters to the editor from Siouxland Voices, and it looks like we got three today. First one comes from Jake Jungers of Sioux City, and the top of his letter, it reads, "Our top officials donating to riverfront redevelopment." And Jake writes, "I see that Parks and Recreation in the city of Sioux City is still seeking donations for the Chris Larson Park redevelopment project in the amount of $50,000. I wonder if any of our council members or mayor, city manager, or Parks and Recreation director have donated themselves. Also, I wonder if all the, quote, big corporate players have donated yet. It would seem that such an important project for the future of Sioux City would be funded effortlessly. Maybe we can use the COVID relief dollars towards this project? Question mark. Signed, Jake Jungers of Sioux City. Next letter, writer writes, is from Greg Nooney of Sioux City. And the title of Greg's letter is Questions Cal Thomas's Depth of Feeling Argument. In Cal Thomas's column that appeared in the Journal on June 3rd, he objects to the bipartisan commission to investigate the January 6th riots at the U.S. Capitol. He presents his preferred alternative, which is to investigate the, quote, the depth of feeling held by those rioters who believe their country is being taken away without their consent. He hypothesizes some of the sources of that, quote, depth of feeling as worries about the national debt, immigration, critical race theory, and allowing transgender people in the military. I've read his columns for years and have yet to hear him express any concerns about the, quote, depth of feeling of the families of black and brown men and women killed by police, immigrant mothers who had their children snatched from their arms at the border, transgender children who completed suicide, survivors of the Tulsa riot, or parents of black and brown children giving them, quote, the talk. Personally, I doubt that any of the rioters were there to protest the national debt. He may be right, however, that the rioters want to return to the boundaries established by the founders, which include the right of white men to own black people, denying women the right to vote, and the state-sponsored genocide of indigenous people. Signed, Greg Nooney of Sioux City. Next and final letter is courtesy of Dr. Dick Hedinger of Sioux City, and top of his letter is, thanks to, quote, courteous people at Sertoma Park. And he writes, I'd like to thank the courteous people that use Sertoma Park. Our club has been the force for that park that had a cleanup day last week. A dozen Boy Scouts and 8 club members. We struggled to find enough trash to fill 2 trash bags. The trash containers were all full, so we know people were picking up after themselves. A big thanks to the people with pride in what they have in Sioux City. The Scouts also installed a new flag that day. There is also a flag retirement burn center being installed by them. Good things happening in a good city. Signed, Dr. Dick Hedinger of Sioux City. And at the bottom, let's do the other voices. This is Lance Morgan. He's a member of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska and the CEO of Ho-Chunk Inc. And Ho-Chunk obviously is a big enterprise here in Sioux City with the downtown Ho-Chunk Center. From Lance Morgan. Nebraska's history is filled with interesting stories about Native Americans. Perhaps the most well-known story is the story of Ponca Chief Standing Bear, who was tried in court in 1879 for returning to his homeland to bury his son against federal orders. The U.S. attorney had argued that Standing Bear was not a person under the law. Standing Bear is famously quoted as saying in court, quote, I am a man. The court agreed for the first time that an Indian is a person. Representing Nebraska, a statue of Chief Standing Bear is on display in the U.S. Capitol's National Statuary Hall. The Omaha tribe also has a great historic figure. Dr. Susan LaFleche was the first female Native American doctor, and she opened a hospital on the Omaha Reservation in 1913. While Dr. LaFleche's achievements as a physician are remarkable, she was not considered an American citizen because of her race. For her many accomplishments, she will soon have her own statue on Nebraska's Centennial Mall in Lincoln. I'm a member of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska. We have lots of great figures from our historic and modern era, and I want to share one that is important to me and the Winnebago people. My great uncle was U.S. Army Sergeant First Class John Rice. He was awarded the Bronze Star and a Purple Heart for his heroism in the Pacific Theater in World War II. For his extraordinary actions leading a squad of soldiers in one of the opening battles of Korea, he was awarded the Korean Service Medal, United Nations Service Medal, National Defense Service Medal, Korean Presidential Unit Citation, and the Republic of Korea War Service Medal. At age 36, Sergeant Rice was killed in action in Korea on September 6, 1950. His remains were not returned to his wife until the summer of 1951. His wife, Evelyn, was a white person living in Sioux City. She searched for a place to bury her husband and was turned down by local cemeteries because Sergeant Rice was a Native American. Mrs. Rice did finally secure a plot in a private cemetery when the employees assumed that because she was white that Sergeant Rice was too. During the service, my great uncle received full military honors with a 3-volley salute. The service had not yet concluded when one of the employees of the cemetery noticed several Native Americans in attendance. Upon discovering Sergeant Rice was a Native American, the service was halted. The widowed Miss Rice was forced to endure the indignity of removing her husband from his own grave and leaving the cemetery with his body. Harry Truman was president in 1951. He heard what happened and chastised the white-only policy of the local cemetery. He ordered the remains of Sergeant Rice to be brought to Arlington National Cemetery for burial with full military honors. Sergeant Rice was a war hero and made the ultimate sacrifice for his country. However, his death fighting for his country mattered less than his status as a Native American when it came to burying his body. I can only imagine the trauma that his widow and her relatives experienced when they were forced to remove this Winnebago patriot from his grave. Their anger, indignation, and pain are impossible for me to fathom. My grandfather served in World War II. My father served in the Vietnam War, and I also served in the U.S. Army. While I was in the Army, I served with people from rural Nebraska, the backwoods of Louisiana, the streets of San Juan, Puerto Rico, and even a guy from Bulgaria who joined the Army so he could become a U.S. citizen. The U.S. military is a melting pot of people from all backgrounds and cultures. We were just American soldiers. When someone's shooting at you, nobody cares about your skin color. Our country has come a long way in race relations since Chief Standing Bear's trial and Sergeant Rice's funeral, but we clearly still have work to do. We must remember these painful stories, acknowledge the past, and work together towards a better future where we are all just Americans. All right, let's do the sports section quickly. Section B, prep soccer, headline, Wolfpack falls in title game. Subheadline, Western Christian loses state championship to Notre Dame from Des Moines. It wasn't the outcome they wanted, but the Western Christian boys soccer team didn't hang its head for long. The Wolfpack came up short in the Class 1A state championship game on Saturday at the Crown Soccer Complex in Des Moines as the team lost to Burlington Notre Dame by a score of 4-1. The Knights scored one goal in the first half and three more in the second half, second to clinch the victory, and finished the season at 23-1-1. For the Wolfpack, it was a disappointing ending to the squad's most exciting season in years. After making it to the state tournament for the first time since 2009, Western Christians still had plenty to be proud of after fighting for what could have been their first state title since 1996. Well, I'm proud of our guys, head coach Sue Backham said, proud of them fighting all game, and hopefully they get a chance in a couple of days to take the time and reflect on the season we've had. We had 16 wins, 2 losses, and it was a really fun group of kids to work with. On Saturday, Notre Dame got the scoring started with a penalty kick in the 12th minute to take a 1-0 lead. In the 44th minute, the Knights scored again to go up by 2. In the 52nd minute, senior Bailey Backham scored on a penalty kick to put the Wolfpack on the board, but Notre Dame responded with another goal of its own in minute 65, another in the 70th minute to take the eventually winning 4-1 lead. Western Christian finished with 6 shots on goal, and goalkeeper Ty Van Essen had 10 saves. Although the team fell short, Bailey Backham kept a positive attitude after the final game of his high school career. Quote, I feel good, Backham said. It was a tough losing, but our main goal was just to get to state, and to get a 2 seed to make it to the championship was huge for us. I'm just excited for the team next year. They lose 2 starters. They're going to be good next year, and I can't wait to see what they do. For the younger Backham, 2021 was a strange season. With last year being canceled due to COVID-19, he went straight from being a sophomore in 2019 to having to be a senior team leader, which took some getting used to. Quote, it was really weird, Billy said. I'm not too vocal. I was just, for 2 years, the small kid. I was quiet. I'd listen. I'd take notes from the other people on our team. Going from that to being the vocal one to the one that had to tell the team what to do, it was tough for me at first, but I think I got used to it a little bit. Backham said the team this season was with 56 points, including 23 goals and 10 assists. Going into the state championship, the Wolfpack senior says that he and his teammates knew that it was going to be a tough game. Notre Dame came in as the number one ranked team in Class 1A and led the state in scoring this year by 31 goals. Quote, I wasn't too bummed out right away, Bailey said. I knew this was going to be a good team. Of course, I wanted to win, but just to make it to this state stage was huge for me. After we hadn't made it here in 25 years, after the game, it was tough for me that we lost, but I was also excited that we were able to make history for this team and this program. With just 2 seniors graduating, the Wolfpack seems primed for another big season in 2022. It's going to be tough, Sue Backham said. It's always a tough task to get out of Northwest Iowa. There is some pretty good soccer up there, but hopefully we can represent well whoever it is that comes out next year. All right, let's quickly recap the weather, and that'll close out our Iris broadcast for today. Today, again, it'll be partly sunny, breezy, and hot. High of 91. Tonight, partly cloudy and mild. Low of 68. Monday, very warm with some sun and some clouds. High of 90 degrees. Low of 68. Tuesday, mostly sunny and very warm. High of 90. Low of 67. Wednesday, hot with times of clouds and sun. High of 92. Low of 68. And Thursday, hot with some sun showers at night. High of 95. Low of 65. All right, folks, that brings us to the end of the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, June 6, 2021. I hope you all have a wonderful week. Until next time, goodbye.